criminal defense lawyer Damon Chironis. He is the founder of Chironis & Parenti. He's an aggressive and effective advocate for people charged with federal white-collar violent crimes, drug and sex crimes. He gets great results. He's been involved in some of the high-profile cases across the country. Damon, thanks again for joining us.
Good afternoon, Karen. Always great to be on your show.
So the defendant, Jose Medina, is a Venezuelan immigrant. From what we know, he was apprehended at the border. He asked to return to Colombia, where he had been living. And instead, for some reason, he was bused to Chicago. Be that as it may, let's talk about how the immigration issues are going to affect the prosecution for the murder of Sharon Gorman.
First, I was actually in court that day on a different case when they had this hearing, and it was interesting because a lot of facts came out from the public defender that no one really expected. But as far as immigration is concerned, it's not going to have all that much of an effect on the actual prosecution. It's a murder trial. It's a murder case. It's going to proceed in Illinois state court. It's going to be the same burden of proof and all of those things. Immigration consequences are what occur usually after conviction. There has been a detainer placed on him. So assuming, this is the type of case where you may never get out of jail, but when the detainer is put on individuals, once they're finished with their sentence, they get held by ICE and then they get deported. So I don't expect anything to happen. I don't think he's going to get deported prior to standing trial or anything like that. So, there's a lot of immigration issues surrounding this in a sort of a broader context. But as far as the case is concerned, it's going to be prosecuted by the Cook County State Attorney's Office, and I don't expect it to have a huge, play in it one way or the other.
Right. So prosecution proceeds as normal. If he gets convicted, the sentence gets completely served. And if there's any time left and he's out, then he gets detained and he goes back to Venezuela or wherever they're deporting him. So it's not going to protect him, and it's not going to necessarily hurt him.
Yeah. And even if he were to win, or if somebody in his situation were to win the case, there would still be an ICE detainer lodged and probably be deported. So it's not dependent on whether you win or lose. If he's in the country unlawfully and they put that detainer on you, they can move to deport you.
Got it. So the press reported that he had been arrested in June of 2023 for shoplifting about $130 worth of goods from Macy's. He was released and didn't show up for his court appearance. And at the time of the murder, a warrant was out for his arrest. Now, I've heard a lot of people who don't like the Safety Act, which went into effect, in September of 2023, after the incident at Macy's, that this was, if Safety Act wasn't in place, this guy would never have done this crime. Can you break this down for us? First of all, tell us again what the Safety Act does and doesn't do, and did that law have any, in fact, impact on what happened?
So the Safety Act is replaced sort of the cash bond, which we've all known for, decades in Illinois. You can no longer post bond. What has to happen is judges need to make a determination as to whether or not, first of all, it's a detainable offense, which I don't believe that misdemeanor was a detainable offense, but it's a detainable offense that you are essentially a danger to the community or a specific individual, and that you're potentially a flight risk. So judges make those determinations. What has happened and what defense attorneys have seen is, for little cases like misdemeanors and things like that, where people probably should not be held, they're being released. But on the flip side of that, it is much harder to get a defendant or a client out for a serious crime. In situations where they used to get I bonds and they could post it, judges, in my experience and in the experience of my colleagues, are really detaining a lot of individuals on cases that would have otherwise been bondable. That's what we've seen.
So I'm going to say this in another way, maybe, and I sort of predicted that this was going to happen. The judge still has to make a determination as to whether the defendant gets out pending trial. And like you said, it has to do with two main things. Are you a danger? And if you commit a violent felony, you probably are. Or if you are a flight risk, then, you have to be detained. But it has nothing to do with money anymore. That's the only thing. And you're saying that for these violent crimes, judges are much less likely to let the person out after the Safety Act, right?
Absolutely. All different types of crimes, people are being detained where historically they wouldn't. Because what would happen is the judge would make sort of an analysis, and some people would be held without bond, but oftentimes the judge would say, okay, you've got to post $100,000 to get out. And some people would come up with that. But now a lot of these judges, first of all, don't want to be on the cover of the Tribune for letting somebody out who commits another crime. And they are making, you know, and sometimes I agree with them, sometimes I don't. They're making an analysis that a lot more of these individuals should be detained for serious crimes. That's just what's happening across the board in Cook County.
So, I mean, for the people out there saying that judges now are releasing everyone because of the Safety Act, that's just not the case. And, you know, if that makes us safer, we are safer after this act. But let's talk about this shoplifting charge. It was a misdemeanor, and like you said, he wouldn't have been held anyway under any law, and it probably didn't have any impact on whether he committed this crime or not. Interesting, Damon, you said you were in court, and I did read a little bit about what the public defender said. Can you tell us what you heard her say and what the new information is that we have on this defendant?
Sure. I mean, she talked about this parade of horribles that this young man had gone through in his life. He'd been the victim of a gunshot wound during a robbery. He had to relearn how to walk and talk. He's got an indentation on his head. He wasn't actually in court. He was there via video. He couldn't read or write. Basically, he was disabled, is what was put forward. He tried to go back to his country, but they didn't do that. They then bust him to Chicago. So she just put more color to his background because nobody really knew much about it. And then maybe not surprisingly, they really didn't ask for him to get released for a couple of reasons. One, he was not getting released. That was not going to happen. No judge in Cook County or the United States would release an individual under these circumstances. And two, she made the argument that it's possible, and it was interesting how she phrased this, that he would get deported to a different country where he wouldn't receive due process, which, you know, if you read between the lines on that, was she thinking that there was going to be, you know, he's going to get deported to one of these crazy prisons and some other country? I don't know exactly what she meant by that, but she did what would be considered sort of mitigating circumstances about his background.
So again, and just because I know the anger about this case and the horror visited on this poor 18-year-old woman who had her whole life in front of her and just was enjoying her life with her friends and comes into contact with this guy, damaged or not, he was violent and he found himself, you know, with a gun in his hand somehow. And if you know, again, allegedly presumed innocent, all of that good stuff. But how is that going to impact the defense, Damon? As you're a defense lawyer, you're a public defender, let's say you're appointed to him. How do you take these facts about his disability and the indentation in his head and his part of his brain actually is missing? Like, how do you make the argument to the judge and the jury that he somehow should be, that should be taken into account?
Well, there's a lot of issues, and I think the first issue that their lawyers are going to look at is whether or not, it has nothing to do with guilt or innocence, is he fit to stand trial, right? The court has to determine if he can understand the proceedings and assist his lawyer, and a significant brain injury like the one described probably raises what is called a bona fide doubt about his competency. So the public defender might say, before we go further, he needs a psychological evaluation to determine the extent to which he can assist in a defense and he understands what's going on, right? And if he is found competent and moves forward, if he is found not competent, then he sort of gets held sometimes in sort of a psychiatric prison where they try to restore him to competency. So those, I think that's going to be the first issue that will probably come up. And then the issue as to whether or not any of this is relevant towards guilt or innocence is a really interesting question, right? And doctors are going to look at on those types of things. In order to raise like an insanity defense, you would have to establish that whatever is wrong with him, you know, led to him not appreciating the fact that he was committing a crime, right? The difference between right and wrong, those types of things. And that's a very high bar. So I wouldn't expect from what I know, assuming he was involved in this, that they would be able to reach that sort of bar just because he has these types of issues. But there are other ways that, you know, you can defend this case. Guilty but mentally ill is another sort of verdict where a jury looks at it and says, yeah, he's responsible for it, but he's also mentally ill. He goes to prison for the same amount of time, but he gets treatment. So this case has a lot of issues that a lawyer is going to need to look at and determine, a lot of psychological issues, a lot of mental health issues. And it's going to be, I think, a long road until this case goes to trial or gets resolved.
And, you know, on top of that, you know, tuberculosis, as I've read now online, as now we all can, that, you know, can cause people to do violent things. And there's a whole, there are theories about that and some proof from that. So I guess that is going to add into the whole mix. Yeah, it's a tragic case. It's a horrible case. And I'm sure we'll all be following it. We have to talk about Tiger Woods. And I know that nothing is funny about driving drunk or impaired. But I have to say, Tiger Woods is proof that, you know, you can drive well on a fairway, but you don't necessarily fare well on a driveway. Too soon?
Oh, Karen.
That's
Karen,
bad. It's really bad.
You've been woodshopping that one for a while, I think. You delivered it perfectly. Just before we get started, I think I need to say that I'm probably the only lawyer you will ever have on your show or ever talk to who has never played a round of golf in his life and will never play a round of golf for the rest of his life. So that's something, I don't know if I'm proud of it, but, you know, I can't have that many hobbies, you know, with my job and other things I do. So,
well, you're too impatient. That's just not your deal. It's just too, it's
yeah,
too
right.
slow. And, you know, what was it, Mark Twain who said, like, golf is a great way to ruin a nice walk or something. So,
yeah, I'd break a lot of clubs.
Yes, sure. You would. You get a little anger management issues there, Damon. So we know Tiger Woods was involved in a rollover crash in Florida on Friday. He was arrested for DUI. I think this is his third or fourth incident. He had one in 2009, one 2017, and a very serious one in 2021, which resulted in some very serious injuries to him. So yeah, this is number four. He apparently, they believed he was under the influence of medication or drug. They took a breathalyzer, and I guess he was zero for that, but he refused to a urine test. Let's just talk generally, and let's talk under Illinois law. What if this happened in Illinois? Are you required to, first of all, let's talk about required to take a breathalyzer, and the answer is no. And what is the result of not taking a breathalyzer?
Sure. In Illinois, it's called implied consent. So you impliedly consent to taking, you know, chemical testing. If you get pulled over, you can say no. And if you do, your license gets summarily suspended. And you can contest that. But they're basically saying, okay, if you don't want to take a breath test, let's say it's your first DUI, and you refuse, your license gets suspended for a year. Again, you can have a hearing to determine whether that was done properly, but that is what happens. Now, if you refuse to take, you know, if you have a serious case and it's like an injury, you know, they can apply for a warrant and actually take your blood from you, right? They can do that. They can bring you to the hospital. They can hold you down and they can take it, but they got to get a warrant for that. But no, you can absolutely say you do not want to take chemical testing.
So what do you think so without with a breathalyzer of zero or whatever it was, and he did not give a urine or blood sample. So how are they going to prove their case? I mean, the wreck is proof, but what would be the evidence that would convict him beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yeah, they're much harder cases to prosecute for the state when they don't have chemical evidence, or even, you know, alcohol cases are maybe a little easier because you're going to have the strong odor of alcohol on somebody's breath. You know, the police always write the same thing in the report, strong odor of alcohol on breath, bloodshot, glassy eyes, all those types of things. With a case like this, and anytime somebody is under the influence of pills or marijuana or something like that, and there's no chemical testing, they have to establish that they were on something, right? And that they were impaired. You know, you don't get a free walk just because you don't take a breath test. So it's going to be interesting to see how they go about that. Of course, you know, they're going to talk about their observations, how he spoke, how he looked, how he maybe performed on field sobriety tests. Now, it's interesting, you know, he did tell them, from what I read, that prior to the field sobriety test, he talked about all of his surgeries and those types of things, which really is sort of laying the foundation for, well, if I didn't pass these, it's not because I was impaired. It's because I had these surgeries and couldn't move. So it's an uphill battle. You know, they might try to subpoena records for prescriptions. There's a lot of things they could do, and it's not the type of case they're going to walk away from. But the standard is the same. Was he operating a motor vehicle? and was he impaired based on some substance that he was on? And they're going to have to try to prove that any way they can through observations, video, driving, proof that he took it, those types of things.
Which leads me to the next question, which is in this state, marijuana is legal. It's still illegal to drive after using marijuana. But I don't know about you, but I walk down the street every day and sometimes even in the early morning and I smell marijuana all over the place. And I suspect more people are using marijuana than we think. How do the police test to see if you are impaired if they stop you for a driving incident? How would they know? Yeah, and first, is there a test or are they working on a test?
First, either that or there's a lot of skunks running around the city.
Seriously,
of Chicago,
but exactly.
I've noticed that too. Just imagine a scenario where somebody gets pulled over and, the craziest scenario, you got Cheech and Chong, right? You get pulled over and, there's smoke coming out of the windows and they find a blunt or something in the car, and the person gets out and they're staggering. A judge is probably going to convict somebody. But what normally happens is somebody gets pulled over and the police say they smell an odor of cannabis in the air. Maybe they have bloodshot eyes. Maybe they're a little slow. And if they don't take a blood test or a urine test, it's really difficult to prove. In Illinois, they do have sort of a rule. The legal limit is 5 nanograms or more of THC per milliliter of whole blood, which basically means there has to be an amount in there that they can sort of test. And if you have a blood test and it comes below that, then it's not a per se offense. You can still be charged. So long story short, they've got to prove you had marijuana in your system. They've got to prove you smoked it. And they have to prove that it impaired your driving. Now,
I'm sorry, we got the Blackhawks Live coming up, so I'm going to have to break. Damon, thank you so very much for joining us, and I'm sure you'll be back again very soon.